Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All the material for the discussion on the Habitat MPA Ecosystems Committee work is behind tab 7. And toward the back, document number 4, I believe it is the meeting summary from the most recent meeting of the Habitat Committee. So everyone should have that material, as well as a disc that was sent to everyone that includes previously approved EFH, or mostly previously approved preferred alternatives and the full range of alternatives for the new EFH designations for the omnibus habitat amendment that's been in the works. So again, if you take a look at the meeting summary, document number 4, you'll see the committee last met on January 16th, and most of the business of the committee was approving for public comment the draft EIS that you have in your binder behind tab 7. There were a couple other things that the committee did, including talking about how to better comment or more effectively comment on non-fishing activities and to comment on the Marine Protected Areas National Framework document. But again, most of the business of the committee was focused on the Omnibus Habitat Amendment. And what I want to do is just point out and make sure everybody's kind of oriented to some of the decisions that have been made over the last year regarding this amendment, and then just turn it over to Leslie Ann, who will update everyone on the decisions that are to be made today, because she can do it more clearly than I can. Just so everybody remembers, or to remind you all, last June of 06, the full council approved EFH alternatives for 25 of 27 species, and that motion passed the full council unanimously on a show of hands. At the next council meeting, September 06, there were 4 motions that passed the full council. One was the preferred alternatives for Atlantic salmon. The other was for red crab. Those were the 2 species that still had a little bit of work to be done. Those were approved by voice vote. Also at the September 06 meeting, the council approved the range of alternatives for habitat areas of particular concern. And lastly, there was a voice vote on inclusion of the prey species document, which is included in the material that you have before you today. At the November 06 meeting, the full council approved 1 additional HAPC alternative for the Great South Channel, and that was approved unanimously by a roll call vote. So all of these decisions are by way of saying that we've been working over this document for a while. This is not all new material to the council. We've been working hard at the committee level to get to a consensus and near unanimity, if not always unanimity, on the motions that we bring forward to the council. So that's kind of where we are in the process of approving this phase 1 for the EFH habitat amendment. And I want to turn it over to Leslie Ann, who's going to just update everyone and orient you all to the decisions that were made at the January 16th meeting, which are by decision of the committee brought forward to you today in the form of 1 motion, which will be offered once Leslie Ann finishes giving her update on where we are with the habitat amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. There are 2 main sections to this document. The main section you got in printed copy, and you got a CD mailed to you as well. This CD contains the actual EFH designation alternatives. It's about 700 and something pages. It covers about 200 megs of space, which is why we decided not to print it out, but rather to save a tree, put it on a CD, and send it to you all. It's also available on our website, so if you want to see it electronically other than on a CD, you can do it that way. So the DSCIS is in front of you. We have been calling this an EFH omnibus amendment for quite a while, and I wanted to point out the reason why we're calling it an omnibus amendment, which is on the front page of the DSCIS, which is document 2A in your binder. As you can see, this document is Amendment 14 to groundfish, Amendment 14 to scallops, Amendment 3 to herring, Amendment 4 to monkfish, Amendment 1 to red crab, Amendment 2 to skates, and Amendment 3 to the Atlantic salmon FMP. So this document simultaneously amends all of the fishery management plans under the jurisdiction of this council, in addition to the monkfish plan that's managed jointly, as you know, through the Mid-Atlantic Council. Just as a little bit of history, I went down to the Mid-Atlantic Council meeting in December to get that council to approve the monkfish EFH designation alternatives because the plan is joint with monkfish for monkfish, so we needed to have them do that, and they did. They also, and Jimmy can correct me if I misstate this, they also agreed to approve the DSCIS based on the vote of this council. So they allowed us to do that. With that said, I'm going to go over briefly the document. It is large, and I'm going to try to boil it down into 10 minutes. So, I think I do this every time and come in front of you, but I just want to remind you what species we manage. This is the species for which the New England Council manages. There's 27 of them. There's an asterisk next to monkfish because we manage it jointly again with the Mid-Atlantic Council. You just want to familiarize yourself with these species. I can recite them alphabetically to you if you need me to. They are in this list alphabetically. That's the only weight or preference that's given to them is how they fall alphabetically. There are three goals today as I see it. We need to review the DSCIS for phase one. And in phase one, we have EFH designation alternatives. We have habitat area particular concern designation alternatives, or HAPC alternatives. We have an evaluation of prey species for the species in our fishery management units. So for all 27 species, we have a prey species section. And we have an evaluation of the potential impacts of non-fishing activities on EFH. These are the four major topics that we are covering under phase one of this amendment. There will be phase two, and I'll talk to you about that after we get through phase one. So the goal today is to review it. The second goal is to approve some additional EFH designation alternatives for life stages that were proxied by juveniles and or adults under the status quo designations. The plan development team sort of overlooked the notion of putting forward a range of alternatives to the council for those species that under the current EFH designations were designated EFH based on proxies for juveniles and adults. A lot of times we don't have a lot of information for the eggs or larvae life stage of species. So under the original amendment, for those egg and larvae species, EFH designations were decided on based on the distribution and abundance of juveniles or adults for that same species. Bless you. There are nine species that fall into that category, and those are cod, monkfish, ocean pout, pollock, red hake, redfish, winter flounder, and silver hake and white hake. The reason that we don't need to approve additional EFH alternatives for silver hake and white hake is because they were originally included in the EFH alternative list because there was additional information that we could use to improve those designations. And the reason why we didn't put forward egg and larvae improvements for these species originally is because there really are no new data for egg and larvae species, egg and larvae life stages. The MARMAP data for which we rely on for a lot of our egg and larvae information was done in a discrete time period that ended in the late 80s, and we don't have any new and additional information for that, which is generally why there are no egg and larvae EFH designation alternatives in this document. But for these nine species, we feel that the PDT felt that we do have new information because we have new information on the juveniles and adults for which the proxy was based. Therefore, if we have new information on the juveniles and adults, we should use that new information to create new alternatives for eggs and larvae. Does everybody understand that? So, for instance, for juveniles and adults, we have new years of survey data. We have new inshore data. We have a lot of new things for juveniles and adults that can help us improve the egg and larvae designations for those species that were proxied by juveniles and adults originally. So in the actual EIS, those new alternatives are included just to save time, but they're also listed in document number 3 separately. So this document contains the additional EFH Omnibus Amendment 2 designation alternatives, and Sally's motion will cover those. And then the third goal is to approve the entire DSCIS for public comment. As an overview, this DSCIS is a combination Magnuson Act document and EIS, which is a NEPA document, which is the way we produce all of our documents. It contains an executive summary, background and purpose, goals and objectives, and those are found in sections 1, 2, and 3 in the document. Section 4 contains the management alternatives under consideration. Section 4.1 is the CD. So if you go to section 4.1, it says, go look at the CD. Section 4.2 describes the HAPC alternatives. Section 5 has the additional EFH components that we're required to do, which are the prey species evaluation and the evaluation of non-fishing impacts. Just want to point out that you've already approved all of these sections with the exception of the non-fishing impact section. Section 6 is an affected environment section. It's broken down into three main sections. We describe the biological and physical environment for which this action covers, and as you can imagine, it covers all the way from Canada down to the North Carolina-South Carolina border, so it attempts to describe that biological and physical environment. It also describes the economic environment of that geographic area as well as the social environment. Section 7 is what we call the environmental consequences. That's the NEPA speak for the analysis of the impacts of the alternatives. 7.1 includes the EFH alternatives and the impacts to the three different areas in the affected environment that we described. These are called VECs. I'm sure you've heard this crazy NEPA speak word before. But VECs are valued ecosystem components. We have three VECs for this action: the biological and physical environment, the economic environment, and the social environment. So therefore, we look at the alternatives and evaluate them against those VECs. So 7.1 is analysis of the alternatives to those VECs as compared to the no-action alternative. 7.2 is the analysis of the HAPC alternatives, and again, it is analyzed relative to those three VECs. And 7.3 is an analysis of the cumulative effects. Section 8 is our data and research needs. Section 9 is our Magnuson-Stevens Act consistency section. Section 10 is other applicable law, anything that would impact us, like Endangered Species Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, any executive orders. Section 11 through 14 are just NEPA housekeeping sections, like where did you hold your public meetings, who was in your list of preparers, things like that. And Section 15 are the appendices. There are a number of appendices to this document. I'm going to briefly just go over an overview of the impact analysis. These are just basic summaries of the analysis for both the EFH designation alternatives and the HAPC designation alternatives. With respect to the biological and physical environment and the EFH designation alternatives, there's actually no direct environmental or economic impacts of designating essential fish habitat because it is just that. It's a designation. There's no management restrictions attached to those designations. However, the document does admit that it could lead to indirect impacts because EFH designations would trigger other Magnuson-Stevens Act requirements to minimize adverse effects of fishing on EFH and also to consider the effects of non-fishing actions on EFH. It's interesting because we sit here and we talk mostly about fishing and fishing impacts, but designating EFH has a large impact on the non-fishing world because every time that a federal entity proposes a project, they have to do an EFH assessment, and it's based solely on the EFH for which this council designates. So there is actually an outside nexus to non-fishing impact projects that you should be aware of that these decisions affect. The effects of this are difficult to analyze because they're indirect, and they're dependent on separate future actions by a variety of entities, including NIMS and the council. In addition, for instance, the Army Corps of Engineers proposes a project. They have to do an EFH assessment. It affects their assessment. The U.S. Coast Guard is now the permitting authority for LNGs. Is that right? Right. So they have to do an EFH assessment. So designating EFH affects those agencies as well. The alternatives comprise a large range of options that use different methodologies as a result in different geographic areas being identified as EFH. I've talked to you at length several times about the methods that we've used to designate EFH. As you can imagine, the results of those different methods provide a different geographic range for EFH. Generally, designating EFH would have a positive effect on habitat because the whole purpose behind the designation is to identify important fish habitats that would be subjected to potential measures that could possibly protect them, conserve them, and enhance them. I want to note that Alternative 2, which is the modified abundance-based alternative, and Alternative 3, which is the abundance plus habitat alternative, would designate significantly less area than the no-action alternative. And even alternative 4, which if you recall is the 100% cumulative catch alternative, which essentially designates EFH on the entire range of the species, which was largely thought to be the extreme of the range of alternatives, would only designate a slightly larger total area than the no-action alternative. So in really no case do any of these alternatives designate any area larger than what we currently have for EFH. And some of you might laugh at that because it seems like everything is EFH for something, but there you have it. None of these alternatives have a larger geographic area significantly than the no-action alternative. In terms of impacts on the economic environment, there are no management rules or regulations that are created in Phase 1 that would impact the economy, small entities, or consumers, either positively or negatively. However, considering different ways to designate EFH will likely lead to deliberations by the Council during Phase 2 about whether and how to restrict fishing and gear and practices as a function of EFH attributes. If you recall, the next Phase 2 is to evaluate gears and gears' impacts on fish habitat. And if any of those impacts exceed the threshold of not more than minimal and less than temporary in nature, we have to minimize those impacts. So there is sort of a secondary impact of designating EFH, but you can't really quantify that at this point. Impacts in the social environment are very similar. Phase 1 does not create any management rules or regulations, so therefore it doesn't have any direct impacts. It does designate EFH, which may at some future date be used in the creation of fully closed areas or areas closed to particular gears or particular times of the year or other regulations, which you're all familiar with our current suite of habitat measures. The HAPC designation alternatives, with respect to the biological and physical environment, there are 9 main HAPC alternatives that are analyzed in the document. We analyze these with respect to the 4 EFH final rule criteria that are set out in the final rule for becoming an HAPC. And we also evaluated them relative to the 4 council preferences. The council identified preferences in the types of HAPCs they'd like to see included. And we evaluated those based on that as well. And also the analysis includes why the area may be special and how they meet the criteria and the council preferences. With respect to the HAPCs, because they're defined boundaries, they're essentially, for the most part, boxes or some form of a polygon, we were able to evaluate those areas with respect to both the currently defined EFH and the preferred alternative EFH. If you recall, you approved a bunch of preferred alternatives for each species in each life stage, and we were able to take that potential new EFH and evaluate the HAPC alternatives relative to that as well, because we thought that just evaluating it relative to the current EFH wouldn't really tell you the full story about what could potentially happen. Within the analysis, we talk about the total designated EFH for species and life stage. So we, you know, within the area, what species and life stages have identified EFH in there, how big the area is, the percent of the total species and life stage EFH inside the HAPC alternative. So for instance, of all the juvenile cod EFH that's designated both under the status quo and the preferred alternative EFH, how much of that EFH in total is included in this particular alternative? And we set a 1% threshold because at a certain point you get teeny tiny pieces of EFH of different life stages in the box, so we just set a 1% threshold and eliminated everything underneath that. And we also include the percent of the area that is EFH for a species and life stage. So, for instance, if you have an area, how much of that particular area is EFH for something? So what we included in the analysis was if 50% of the area is EFH for a species or a life stage, we included it. And in many cases, some of the areas are 100% EFH for certain species and life stages. For the deep sea canyon alternatives, because there's very little EFH designated in the deep sea canyons today under the status quo, what we did is we just provided you a list of what EFH is included for each species and life stage under the status quo and under the preferred alternative. Again, the conclusions for the economic and social environment under HAPCs is very similar. Again, there's nothing proposed in Phase 1 that would impact the economy or the social environment. But because the Council solicited recommendations from the public, if you recall, when we put out the RFP a couple years ago, we asked the public, when they proposed an idea, what type of management restrictions would they suggest, if any, and they did provide those. So it's apparent that now that you have these special areas designated, that there potentially could be some future action to protect that area And that was at least admitted that that is a possibility in the document. And the social environment conclusions are the same. So the next steps to this document, obviously we need to do a little cleanup. We have a couple of required sections, tertiary sections that need to be completed, and we need to submit the document to the agency. Our plan is to submit it in late February, early March. We've been advised by the NEPA staff that we are allowed to have a 45-day comment period. We're hoping that this comment period will start in March or early April, and we are planning on having two public hearings, one at the council meeting, this council meeting in April, and one at the Mid-Atlantic Council meeting in April. And after that point, we'll bring the comments to the committee. The committee will recommend final measures for phase one, and we'll bring those to you in June. I think that was 10 minutes.
11 and a half, but that was good. Thank you. Sally?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a motion on behalf of the committee to make. The motion is to recommend to the council the approval of the DSEIS with modifications approved at the committee meeting on January 16th, 07, for public comment. And that motion passed at the committee unanimously.
Okay, there it is. We have a committee motion. Doesn't require a second. Discussion on the motion.
If I could just give a bit of background, Mr. Chairman.
Go for it.
You'll see from the meeting summary, this motion actually includes eight motions that were made during the meeting on the species that Leslie Ann was talking about during her presentation. It took a little while for me to kind of understand why these were being brought forward as suggestions from the PDT, but it's really pretty simple now that I understand it. But we added these additional alternatives for species where, even though there's no new information on egg or larval stages, there is new information on juvenile and or adult stages for these eight species. So the PDT was recommending that the life stages for which EFH is determined using juvenile or adult data as a proxy, that those should be added to the document. So these are additional alternatives that were added for eight species based on the fact that we have new information on the older life stages that are used as a proxy for the earlier life stages. I hope that's clearer than mud, because it took a little while for me to understand that. It makes perfect sense to me. I hope it does to everyone else. If it doesn't, then I hope we'll have some discussion here. The committee decided to put all these all together in one motion, bring them forward to you today. If there are any questions or discussion on that.
Any questions? Any comments? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just to make sure I've got the process, the protocol squared away. If we adopt this motion, then we take the entire document out for public comment. And when it goes out to public comment, the public will be told that, for example, on page 32 and 33 of this document, there are goals and objectives for the amendment, and all of the material within this document that they have to review is specific to goals 1, 3, 8, and objectives 1, 2, 3, and 4, not numbered, but they're the first four objectives, correct? The public will then say, okay, what about goals 2, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and the other objectives? What would the response be regarding how the council would then deal with that additional business, which would be the next phase?
You read the document. Well, if you go back a page on page 31 under the preamble to the goals and objectives section, it describes how this is a two-phased approach. It tells you why it's a two-phased approach. And it tells you that those things that are in bold on the goals and objectives list will be dealt with in phase one, with the assumption that the other ones will be dealt with in phase two. Maybe it should be more explicit, but if you want it to be, it will be.
Okay, so that means then that the public will have to wait for the next major initiative, which would be for this council to begin and then finish phase two, which would be specific towards our achieving those other goals and those other objectives. And I apologize, I can't recall the timeline for that. You must have mentioned it.
After we get to this motion, I'll give you the phase two timeline.
Okay.
Anyone else? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. It's unanimous. Motion carries 16-0. Sally, anything else?
Yeah, as Leslie Ann mentioned, I think now would be a good time to have the council updated on phase two and next steps.
LA?
Oh, it passed. Okay. Phase two. First of all, just to remind you that phase one is going to go out to public comment. Phase one is essentially volume one to a larger action, which is a two-phased EIS. So it's the hope that after we get back from phase one public hearings and you make your final decisions on things like EFH designations, that in phase two we don't start those all over again and redo those. That's the intent of the phased approach. Phase two is going to start immediately. It'll actually start before phase one is over. Phase two will include reviewing and refining our gear effects evaluation, which we largely did in Amendment 13. I've already spoken to the center with Frank Almeida about the potential changes to the PDT makeup to address the phase two topics, which are very different than the phase one topics, in addition to supporting a potential peer review process for gear effects evaluation. The very first step of phase two is to conduct a gear effects evaluation. Essentially, what are the impacts or the potential impacts of the gears that are used in our fisheries on habitat? When we did that in the past, we've done that on essentially three major gear types. Otter trawl, scallop dredges, clam dredges. That's pretty much the major ones we've done. We've looked at pots and traps, but very few other major gear types. The gear effects workshop that was produced by the agency was done back in 2001. And that was a group, I'm sure some of you were there, that was a group of people who got together to give their opinions on the impacts, the relative impacts of those gear types on habitat. And we conducted a pretty extensive literature-based analysis in Amendment 13. That information is actually, in that those conclusions have never been subjected to any kind of peer review. So we're sort of hoping that with the center's help, we can do that in the short turnaround. The way it would work would be that the PDT would be responsible for reviewing and updating the actual gear effects evaluation and presenting that information to a peer review body sometime in late summer or early fall. And we'll be working with the center to hopefully support that approach. After the gear effects evaluation is done, we need to have the council determine what of those impacts are exceed the adverse impact threshold and need to be minimized. And that'll be brought to you before the end of the year, is our hope. The biggest and probably most controversial section of this entire amendment is to figure out how to minimize those adverse impacts. And if you look at the goals and objectives list that David was just referring to, the plan for the council is to develop a strategy to minimize those adverse impacts across all FMPs simultaneously. So you don't end up having a suite of habitat measures for the scallop plan, a suite for the groundfish plan, a suite for the herring plan if needed. You actually try to integrate and optimize those across all FMPs. Now, I have no idea how we're going to do that, but we're going to give it our best shot, and hopefully it will minimize the amount of conflicts across all the fisheries when it's proposed. If you recall, our habitat advisory panel has been reconstructed to have representatives from each of the advisory panels, the species advisory panels, as well as the enforcement advisory panel. Coast Guard participates in it, the recreational advisory panel, so that we have some kind of integrative way to bounce off ideas for optimizing and integrating these measures across plans. So our hope is that we'll bring something to you by the end of the year in terms of adverse impacts determinations. And what exactly we do with that, we'll need some guidance. If you recall, during Amendment 13 and Amendment 10 and Amendment 2, there was this notion that you need to minimize adverse impacts to the extent practicable. And for the life of us, you know, we never defined what practicable was. So that notion is going to become a lot more important in this go-around because it's going to affect all fisheries simultaneously. So we'll be relying on our economic resources at the center through our PDT to help us come up with potentially some models to do that. But it's going to be no small undertaking. So if you have any questions in addition to phase two, try to entertain them.
Dr. Pierce and then Dr. Weinberg.
I know it's hard to project too far forward because a lot of this is new territory, exploring new areas, new frontiers. You did mention that there'll be a peer review regarding the gear effect evaluation. Of course, that's extremely important, and I suspect that'll happen sometime soon, and that's very relevant to the second goal that's part of phase two. That's to identify, review, and update the major fishing activities that may adversely affect the EFH of the species managed by the council. My question is that, again, projecting ahead, let's assume that after the peer review, we find out that the evaluation indicates that sea scallop gear has a negative effect on EFH habitat for codfish. Does that mean, therefore, that after we identify through phase one what the cod EFH is, that we would be obliged then to put restrictions in place throughout all of the EFH habitat that relates to codfish? I ask this question because this is likely to come out during the public hearing process on phase one, because it's so intimately linked that people will be wondering what the outcome of this will be relative to restrictions on fishing activity in EFH. Not HAPC, which is where people may be thinking right now we may have those sorts of restrictions, but EFH could have some serious restrictions across the board, broad in scope relative to trawling or sea scalloping. I don't expect you to answer this. I'm just kind of, it's anticipating the problem that's going to occur here. So I would hope that, I don't know what I hope. I guess I'm just fearful that the outcome of all of this will be an obligation for us to minimize the impact of bottom trawling or sea scallop dredging throughout all of the EFH that relates to cod or whatever other groundfish species we may be entertaining. So just an expression of fear, and we'll see how it ends up.
Dr. Pierce, thank you for your forecast. Dr. Jim?
Yeah, when you said that you would have ask the center to do a peer review of the gear effects paper, I just wondered if you could clarify that a little bit. I was wondering who you expect the reviewers to be and whether this will just be a review of the document or the authors themselves would come and give presentations. If you could expand a little on that.
Well, the gear effects evaluation also includes an adverse impact determination. So essentially the council needs to determine of those adverse impacts which ones exceed the threshold of being more than minimal and not temporary in nature. And that sort of threshold needs to be decided by the council. And what the document would do that we would provide to any peer review body would be sort of a suggested approach to that, or suggested mechanism. So this is what the impacts are from the gear to particular types of habitat, and how we determined whether or not that impact exceeded the threshold. We did that in Amendment 13. We made the threshold. We decided on a threshold. It was never peer-reviewed. So, for instance, we decided that any impact that was ranked on the vulnerability scale more than moderate, however we define moderate, exceeded the threshold. That's never been peer-reviewed. It was a determination that we made in Amendment 13 because we had a job to do and we didn't have time for peer review at the time. So what the PDT would do would be to update the gear effects evaluation that's in our major documents right now and pitch or put forth a range of ideas of how to establish a threshold and have the peer review review those ideas and tell us which ones are the most appropriate. In my conversations with Frank so far, you know, obviously budgets are a concern and whatnot. We've talked about people outside the center coming in to do the peer review, but how far outside the center, you know, we're not so sure yet. So we're still sort of in the primordial soup of this approach right now.
Okay, thank you. Is that it, Sally? Pat?
Yeah, to that point, I mean, it seems to me that that's exactly the type of thing that the SSC should be doing, especially under its expanded role as envisioned under the reauthorization of the Act.
Okay, anything else under Habitat? L.A.
Did you talk about the MPA framework? You didn't talk about that yet, did you? Document.
The one other thing that the committee talked about was the national framework for marine protected areas, which I'm not sure what the right terminology is, but they've created this draft framework, asked for public comment on it, and the committee talked about it a bit, and they've extended the deadline for comments for another couple of weeks. Comments are due at the end of February. And I think probably the best thing to do, because the committee won't be meeting again before that comment deadline, is perhaps for the executive committee to take a look at the letter before it goes out. And if anyone wants to take a look at that framework document, I think it's mpa.gov is the website, and you'd be able to take a look at that. And if there are any comments that you wanted to add in addition to those that were provided by committee members already, then you could submit those to Leslie Ann. And then if the chair agrees, then perhaps the executive committee could take a look at a final letter.
So this was discussed at the last committee meeting, and committee members had their comments. Staff's constructing a letter, writing a letter, and you're wondering if the executive committee would be the right place to, if the council doesn't object to that, sure. Phil? Then Dave, then Jim?
I don't know that I object to it, but I would wonder, you know, I would hope the council were to get it forwarded to it for at least, if we had some major objection, we could say something. I don't know how that process would work, but kind of looks, I don't know just how that fares out to me.
Dave?
Yeah, originally that letter was due on Valentine's Day. I don't know if there was any significance there or not. But they have extended the comment period to February 28th. For those of you who don't know, my wife is the fishing industry advisor for the United States, the fishing industry advisor to the what's called the FAC, the Federal Advisory Committee to this Marine Protected Area executive order. And she has provided Leslie Ann with a list of bullet points, both that the FAC has commented on as problems with the document, and also items relative to the council's participation in this process that the council may want to comment on. But again, the comments are due by February 28th, so I don't know if you're having an executive committee meeting before that date or not, for your consideration and how to handle this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would suggest that the letter, after the letter is drafted, that it be circulated to the committee members, not necessarily have a committee meeting, just circulated for any comments that the committee members might have in aggregate. Since they've basically been the ones that dealt with these issues, with the exception of Sally, I think the executive committee doesn't have really any current understanding of what's going on, and so I think if they got advice from the committee members, it would be helpful.
That's a fair point. The executive committee isn't even going to meet or isn't scheduled to meet prior to February 28th anyway. I think it's a little outside the norm of how we've done things in the past, but if the council, I think it's a reasonable suggestion that the letter be drafted by staff and then circulated back through the Habitat Committee. And then I'll look it over, and if everything looks fine, we can send it out. You know, we've got a short window of time here. Unless the council doesn't want to provide comments on council letterhead and you as individuals want to go ahead and comment. Jim?
Well, by my comments, I didn't mean to preclude any council members from seeing the letter or making their own individual comments, but it seems to me that the committee would have more current information available, and they should see it and make comment, and maybe that could be coordinated through the email and Sally, and then any other comments that came in from the council could be considered by the chair. Thanks.
Okay. Sally?
That's fine. I was just suggesting another level of review at the council since we don't have the letter today, and the committee is not going to meet again before the end of the month, but that's fine too.
Any other comments on Habitat? Okay, so we're done with the committee's business. Okay, we've got a little extra time here. Looking at tomorrow's agenda, starting at 10:30, we have a groundfish, and that's scheduled to take us through to whenever it takes us to. We've got research steering and a SAW report tomorrow morning. David, would you be able to give your report now?
Yes. I'm scheduled for an hour, right? Tomorrow?
Yeah. Both you and Jim are both scheduled for 1 hour tomorrow.
Okay. I think I can do it in less than an hour.
Well, we can go over 5 o'clock unless there's strong objection from the council. But I'd recommend that we try to pick off some of these things we've scheduled for tomorrow now that we have a little extra time. Phil?
I don't disagree, Mr. Chairman. I just would be curious under research steering if there was people coming for research steering tomorrow. You know, that it's not on the agenda for today. I know we can move stuff around, but I'm a little hesitant that we might not have the audience we would have tomorrow. So, I mean, just that for consideration, I guess.
I guess the other alternative would be to ask Jim if he could give his SAW report now. You want 5 minutes to prep for that, Jim? Okay. Is there any objection to that?
Tell him not to concentrate on
I'm going to go down and talk to him.